This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Today is August 3rd, 2017, and welcome to episode one of our 2017 summer series. To my right are James and Grant.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, guys.
How's it going?
It's excellent. That was a bit of a change of pace for our intro music there.
Yeah.
Pretty nice.
Listen, far be it from me to start the podcast up, but seeing as we are changing things up for the summer, I have to say, James, I'm impressed with your choice of music this week. Well done.
Well, thank you very much. I figured I'd liven the mood up, seeing as it is actually summer.
Yeah, this is like the summer camp for good kids. Nobody got sent here. We all chose to come here, which is excellent. And throughout this series in August, we're going to be having a bunch of conversations with previous guests and talk to them about something that Aaron and I find fascinating, and that's the things they do outside of finance that keep them balanced and centered.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Grant. And when we were conceiving this series and thinking about, what should we do during the August break? It's like, why don't we just flip the script on its head and do something completely unrelated to finance? Talk to them, because so many of our contributors have interesting lives and they have such varied interests. So it was kind of a natural thing for us to do.
And for those finance fans still with us, after we told you we're going to do nothing about finance this week, we're also going to get a bunch of book recommendations. We've had so many requests from listeners of the podcast, subscribers to Real Vision, to find out the kind of books that our guests read. So we're going to talk to them about those and get a few recommendations for you to take to the beach in the last few weeks of summer.
That's actually a perfect segue into the first thing we're going to talk about. Now, we advertised last week that we were going to take a bunch of listener questions and subscriber questions, and that's what we've done for this week's episode. So it's going to be kind of like a Q&A session. I guess we called it Milton's Mailbag internally.
I think we went down the road of alliteration, which is always an easy one to travel.
Yeah, it is. But so that's what we're going to do this episode. We're going to answer some of your burning, pressing questions that Grant and I have sort of collected in our, I guess, subconscious or conscious over the past 5 months of Adventures in Finance. And we're going to address some of those questions today. So, Grant, the first question that I've gotten, this is a question that I've gotten the most out of any other question that we're going to talk about today. And that is, what books would you recommend if someone wants to get into macroeconomics, investing and trading?
Yeah, this is a very, very common question I get asked as I travel around, and it's a great one. I mean, I think everybody should read. For me, I start with history always. I love to read about financial history as opposed to how people build their frameworks first and foremost, and then you kind of get into how individuals have built their careers and built the frameworks within which they invest.
Yeah, I like that approach too, because I think what underlies that view is that, there are humans who are, you're always dealing with humans here. So if you look back in history, you look back in the past, you can actually learn about the cyclicality.
We never change. Right? I mean, it's amazing. on the subject of history, a couple of fantastic books that I've read. I mean, the first one, Charles Mackay's Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. Now, I don't want to lull anybody out there. It's a hard read, right? It's a verbose.
It's
a big
book. I
don't
think so, Grant.
And I go back and forth, but the chapters about bubbles and stuff are fascinating.
Yeah.
But wading through the whole thing is you got to commit to it. It's worth it in the end.
Yeah.
But to me, it's a challenge to get through the whole book. But as I said, worth it. The other one, I've mentioned it before on the podcast, and I can't recommend it highly enough. And I've had people question me, so I need to enunciate this clearly. The Lords of Finance by Liaquat Ahmed.
What was wrong with the previous?
People thought I said the Laws of Finance instead of Lords. Lords, L-O-R-D-S, of Finance. It's a tremendous historical look at central banking back between the World Wars, and so many parallels then to now that I've read this book, I think, four, maybe five times now, and every time I read it, I underline different passages. It's an extraordinary piece of work by Liaquat Ahmed.
And Grant, just to piggyback off of that history theme, I think another book that, I mean, you and I, we've talked about a lot, and we've talked about internally a lot at the office, is Edward Griffin's A Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yes, another excellent, right? Excellent read.
That's one of those books where, I mean, it is a commitment because it's pretty, it's sizable. I mean, that thing, if you drop that on someone's head, I think, you know, get a pretty serious concussion.
But it reads like a good thriller.
It does.
That's the beauty of it.
It does.
It's a story. It just happens to be factual one, which is always interesting. Yeah, the other book we should talk about is Neil Howe and William Strauss's The Fourth Turning, which,
yes,
you know, has been essential reading for a number of years, but arguably never more so than now. You know, it's a study of generations, we are at the fourth turning now. And to read Neil and William's book and understand what that means, I think, is crucial. Not just if you want to invest, but living in the time we do, it's really important to understand the societal forces that are playing out right now.
Yeah, I think if I took an actual tally of all the times the fourth turning was mentioned in Real Vision TV interviews.
Oh, by far, the
by
most,
far, right?
By far the most mentioned book.
Yeah,
no question.
I think so. And I think maybe the second runner-up to that might be Jack Schwager's Market Wizards series.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've tried to stack the deck in favor of Lords of Finance. I've mentioned that, but I think I don't count them all by me. But yeah, Market Wizards, tremendous, tremendous book.
Yeah, and Jack has written numerous volumes over decades, I think, right? And speaking to hedge fund managers, speaking to discretionary traders, just there's so much there. I actually started reading Hedge Fund Market Wizards recently.
Yep.
Got through the Colm O'Shea. He's got, you know, macro traders now onto Ray Dalio, and you know, it's almost like Real Vision before Real Vision kind of was.
Yeah, no, you know, that's a great way of putting it. There's so much information in there. You know, learned information, which is always the most useful to me. These guys have figured this out by doing it, screwing it up, and figuring out what they got wrong. And it's an extraordinary book, the original one, and you know, all the others that Jack's written have all been well worth the read too.
Yeah, absolutely. So for trading, I would say Jack Schwager's Market Wizards series, you should check all those books out. And now specifically onto macro, there are two, I mean, for our show notes here, I put down two names that everyone's going to know, George Soros and Ray Dalio. Ray Dalio wrote The Economic Principles, which is, and there's also a video on YouTube, 30-minute video that I highly recommend people watch. I think it's titled How the Economic Machine Works, and basically runs you through in an animated kind of format how Ray Dalio looks at the world in terms of being an economic machine. But for George Soros, he's written numerous books as well, Soros on Soros, The Crisis of Global Capitalism. So there's a lot of books to dig through there as well. Grant, do you have anyone?
Well, a couple more that I would... Jim Rogers' Investment Biker was something that had a profound effect on me when I read it a long, long time ago. You know, Tim Price recommended Edwin Lefebvre's Reminiscences of a Stockbroker, talking about the life story of, right, Jesse Livermore, which, again, just filled with lessons. And, you know, for me, I've recently reread Mervyn King's The End of Alchemy. And anyone listening to this podcast regularly knows I'm no fan of central bankers, but I have to say the forthright way that Sir Mervyn writes that book is hugely impressive, and he, you know, he doesn't pull any punches, and it's interesting to read a career central banker talk about what the central banks have done since 2008 in the way he does. You know, he owns up to a lot of mistakes. It's by no means perfect, but it's an excellent read. I highly recommend that.
Yeah, it is. So, Grant, I think that about covers it there for that question, because we've just rattled through probably a dozen books that the listeners can already go through. There's going to take a lot of time to go through all those books that we just mentioned.
No, absolutely right. Absolutely right. But hopefully people have either made notes or they can just go back and listen to them again.
All right. Well, Grant, let's move on to the next question that I've gotten, you know, quite a few times already, which is, you know, like, I've been asked, what's your favorite Real Vision TV interview? Now, I know you and I kind of...
Don't. This is Sophie's choice. I'm not
doing
it.
I refuse
to do it.
So I'm going to actually... I'm going to change the question a little bit and not ask you for your favorite, but is there any interview that really kind of surprised you? I mean, I know which interviews really surprised me.
Yeah, that's a much better question. Look, I've done hundreds of these, so there have been plenty that surprised me. I mean, a couple that spring to mind. I mean, the one that jumped straight to mind was the first time I interviewed Daniel Want down in Sydney. You know, Daniel had been introduced to me by a mutual friend of ours, Bigsy, if you're listening, thanks for that. And Daniel and I arranged to meet. I'd seen some presentations he'd done, and we arranged to meet in Sydney. And, you know, I went out at the appointed time to meet my guest. And, you know, I couldn't see him. There was just this kind of really young guy wearing his dad's suit sitting in the foyer. And I'm like, well, where's Daniel? And you know, this guy says, Grant. And I was just blown away by just how young Daniel looked. Now, I will say, Daniel, if you're listening, you certainly look a lot younger than you are. I know that you're not 12 years old. But, you know, when Daniel sat down and started talking to me, my jaw was just on the floor at the profoundness of what was coming out of this, you know, young-looking guy's mouth, and the depth of intellect that Daniel has is extraordinary. And to find that in Brisbane, Australia, completely out of the blue, just, you know, reinforced for me everything we've tried to do with Real Vision, just go and find people that no one's ever heard of and give them a platform. And Daniel was at the very top of that list for me.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, it really is the epitome of what we're trying to do. And I recently rewatched, I think for the third time, Daniel's May 2016 presentation. And if I can borrow a phrase, what struck me there was that, you know, he builds this framework by starting with Sun Tzu and Musashi, like, you know, these great strategists and tacticians, and, you know, understanding the art of war and understanding your competition and using that framework to approach markets. I love that. You know, he didn't start with an economics textbook.
Yeah.
He start with, you know, these books about war and strategy.
Well, like, so I spoke to Daniel about war and religion, and he brings all these things into his thinking. And again, you're going back to a point earlier on about this being a human story, as are wars, as are religion. All these things are about how humans interact with each other. So, I mean, they're perfectly applicable to markets and investing. What about, I mean, have you had any interviews that that surprised you?
Oh, I mean, that's a really hard question. I think when I look back at the balance of videos and interviews that I've watched, be it my time here at Real Vision or before when I was a fan, I think Steve Diggle, really surprised me. One, because when first time I watched him, I had no idea who he was, right? And then you find out, wow, this guy made a lot of money for investors in 2008 by being on the right side of the trade. But
you contrast that with the fact that he was dumb enough to hire me at some point in his career. Yeah, right. Okay.
No, but maybe. No, I'm kidding, Grant. Absolutely not. I mean, with Steve Diggle, what surprised me the most was that, I mean, one, he recognized that, you know what, this system is rigged. I'm going to get out of it. And instead of just, you know, going off and you know, kind of going off into the sunset, I mean, he's actively investing in real things like farms, like German real estate and UK biotech. And in terms of, you know, being a volatility and options trader in the financial markets, and then turning that into like using that concept and creating it out of real stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I mean,
it's amazing. It's genius.
Obviously, Steve's a great friend of mine. I've known him for many years. And, you know, I don't know if he's listening or not, but I will say it because I've said enough people have heard me say it. You know, he's that guy that I have never had a conversation with that he didn't know more about it than I did, except gold. That's the one thing I think he'll have to kind of bow to me on. But, you know, Steve's a true polymath, and you know, the interview didn't surprise me because I know him so well, but I know it surprised a lot of people. You know, as did Stephen Streeter. You know, Stephen was suggested to me by his cousin, Tom, out in Dubai. And he said, you know, and Tom has sent me several recommendations, all of whom have been fantastic. And he said, you know, I keep forgetting, you need to interview the smartest guy I know. It's my cousin. So I was like, all right, well, you know, great, we'll interview him. Everyone you've sent us so far has been amazing. And Raoul went to do the interview, and I remember him calling me right before he had to do the interview. And I picked the phone, and he said, Grant, it's Raoul. Who the hell is Stephen Streeter? Who is he? What am I doing? I said, look, he's this guy's cousin, and, you know, he founded a video game company, and, you know, he's a private investor, but, you know, he's just a super smart guy. And, you know, an hour and 10 minutes, the phone rings, and it's Raoul again. I said, oh, he said, Grant, it's Raoul. I said, yeah. He said, I'm just picking my jaw up. He said, I've just sat there for an hour, just spellbound by the intellect of Stephen. I mean, it's those little nuggets that are just such a pleasure to find, you know. I mean, no one's ever going to hear of Stephen Streeter unless he was on Real Vision, and he's just such an intellect. It's frightening.
Well, I'm sure our listeners have their own ideas about, you know, which favorite interviews they have and who surprised them the most, but, you know, I'm sure I could probably name a couple more who were really surprising.
Oh,
we could go on
names out. You know,
guys, there are tons of names.
Guys like Chris Cole. And
yes.
David Hay up in Seattle, you know, Simon Mikhailovich, we get so many emails about guys like that. And
James Crawford.
Yeah, exactly right.
All these guys.
There's so many of them. And, you know, look, and listeners, please feel free to send us the guests that you like and the people you want to hear more from, because we'd love to have them back on and ask them some more questions on your behalf.
Absolutely. Well, Grant, I want to move on to the next question, which I'm not sure if you've gotten as much as I have, but I've definitely got this, I think, at least six times asking, Aaron, how do you get into the industry? How do you get into trading? How do you get into hedge funds? And I'm like, well, one, I don't work for a hedge fund or working in trading. I mean, I work in financial media right now, but I don't know. I mean, given your experience and given the little experience that I have, I think this is a pretty interesting question because a lot of people who listen to our podcast who follow Adventures in Finance are either working in the industry or trying to get into the industry. So I thought this might be a good question for us to kind of talk about and discuss to see if there's any insight we can provide to people.
Yeah, it's, you know, for me, don't forget, I mean, I got into this industry a lifetime ago and it was very, very different. You know, back in the mid 80s, it was much easier to get into this business. It wasn't such an appealing place for people to go. You know, we were sort of 2 or 3 years into a bull market after a horrible bear market. So, you know, the stock market wasn't a place people wanted to be. You know, I've seen that change over the years. You know, and as the market ran up, obviously it attracts a lot more people. So you've seen thousands of people trying to apply for, you know, tens of jobs, and that naturally creates that difficulty of finding a way into the industry. But you know, I think the common theme that's run through as we've talked to people, you'll get a chance. It's about building a network. It's about getting close to the right people. And you know, the advent of something like Twitter, for example, is a great way to engage.
So true.
Yeah, to engage really smart people that you'd never have a chance of talking to. And it's interesting how these conversations develop. You know, and I know plenty of guys who've hired guys that they started talking to on Twitter because they just displayed that depth of intellect in those conversations. They just wanted to find out more. So, I don't think there's any hard and fast rules of how to get into an industry. To me, what's more important is once you're in, what you do and how you adapt to the industry and you know, the rules you need to live by once you're in the industry.
That's probably a great follow-up onto this question. I guess let me just add my two cents with, I kind of, once I finished university or as I was in university, I kind of followed the track, you know, the pedigree, like, you know, I made sure I did all the extracurriculars, had the right grades, took the right classes, talked to the right people, do your summer analyst program at Morgan Stanley, whatever. And then you just follow down this path. But I think the people who are going to be successful in the future are not going to follow this track. In some ways, you're going to find your own way. And I think we've talked about many times on Real Vision and, you know, be a contributor as Raul or you, where there's this definancialization that's happening. Now, who knows? Maybe they rewrite the Volcker rule and they reinstate proprietary trading at the big investment banks. But barring that, I mean, we're going through some sort of system shift here where we've had people talk about less collateral. So, I mean, it's just like less trading that's going on in the world. So if you want to get into this, I think probably going your own way is better than following.
Well, yeah, it's funny you bring that up, Aaron, because again, this speaks to this idea of cyclicality that we touch on so often. You know, back in the 80s, I turned down a place at university to go into finance at the age of, I mean, I just turned 18 because it was what I wanted to do and I had that opportunity. You know, then you go through your career and you reach the apex where you can't even get an interview unless you've got, you know, an MBA or an undergrad degree in economics. And now we're coming down the backside again and people are starting to say, you know, do I really want to go to university and give up 4 years of potential real-world experience, or should I do that and study in my spare time? So we are on the backside of that cycle. And I think you're right. The traditional way, or at least the traditional way for the last 20-odd years of getting into finance, you know, undergrad, MBA, down that road, you know, I think it's coming to an end.
Yeah. And now to move back to what you were saying, you mentioned rules to live by while in the industry. So for our listeners who are already in the industry working, you know, how many years they've been working, what are some of the rules that you'd say that are important to live by?
There's no two ways about it. This industry attracts a lot of, let's call them type A personalities. And I think when you're young in this business, you have to find the right mentors. You have to find the people who teach you the right way to do things. And oftentimes you have to look for those people because the noisiest, brightest, shining guys that everyone's attracted to and everyone can't help but hear and listen to are not always the guys you want to listen to and not always the guys you want to follow. And the guys sitting in the corner, getting their heads down, working hard, doing the thinking, doing the prep, doing the research, you know, these are the guys. There's a work ethic in finance that you know, I think has dissipated over the years. Certainly the perception of it has with you know, all these movies that come out about high-flying traders and what have you. That work ethic, that depth of knowledge you need and an understanding of what it is you do, and you know, to me, obviously, I'm going to go back to it again, but history. Seek out the right people to teach you. Seek out the people who've done it, and you had to ask someone, hey, who's that guy in the corner? Who's that guy that doesn't say much over there? Because generally speaking, I bet you he was the guy that was around through the 82 crash or the 82 bear market bottom, the 87 crash, the Asian crisis. That's the guy who's been through all those things. He didn't make a lot of fuss about it. He just got his head down and worked hard. And those people, if you can find two or three of those to help guide you, they are invaluable.
I think you make a really interesting point, Grant, about the sort of the quiet guys versus the maybe more the guys who are more out there. I recently listened to an interview Joseph Badaracco, and he wrote this book called Leading Quietly, An Unorthodox Guide to Doing the Right Thing. And basically looked at, I think, like a 200-year history of leaders, world leaders, military leaders, corporate leaders. And, you know, you categorize them and try and find those common traits that make, you know, good leaders great leaders. And he found that, you know, it's not always those ones who are the loudest, who are out in front of everybody, that are the best kinds of leaders. I mean, there are many ways to lead. And to find this, to have the, I guess, the presence of mind to, you know, because a trading floor can be pretty frenetic, right? Hectic. Yeah. There are tons of big personalities out there. But if you can kind of get past that and find the people who can really teach you something, who have that experience and are, as you said, like really putting in the work, then it could be a great learning and mentorship opportunity.
Yeah, it is. And look, it's not there's no exclusivity to this. I mean, there are plenty of guys that have big public profiles. You know, the guy that springs to mind immediately is Carl Best. You know, Carl has a big public persona. He's incredibly well known. He's a erudite, handsome guy that gets out there, and he has a great media presence. But you know, you sit and talk to Carl about markets, and there's just a depth to his knowledge and the way, you know, I've seen him interact with people. He and I were on a speaking tour together, and you know, he's a rock star. And he's surrounded by people, and he took so much time to talk to everybody and answer their questions. You know, and it's standing back and observing people in those moments, you know, how they treat people, how they interact, and how giving they are of their time and their wisdom. You know, they're the guys you watch that, some of that, and you go, you know, here's a guy who I want to learn from. I want to you know, really kind of get into how they do what they do. It's a great business filled with so many interesting people, and they're everywhere. So just people have to keep their eyes open and look out for them.
All right, Grant, I'm going to throw you a curveball here. Which contributor has the best hair?
That's the easiest question in the world to answer. Bill Fleckenstein. There's no question about it.
I don't know. Greg Weldon for me.
Listen.
He's got the best locks.
I don't know. I mean, look, I can't see. My eyes are too bad. I can't see as high as Greg's head. To me, Fleck's hair, it's the eighth wonder of the world.
All right, so Grant, let's move on to our next question that we got from one of our Twitter followers by the handle of Kochu Galen. And he asks, what will happen to the famed Eurodollar market after the LIBOR system gets discontinued?
Yes, and so we have a fair few questions about the Eurodollar system. And we thought, you know what? Aaron and I could sit here and answer this all day, and we'll never come up with an answer as smart as Jeffrey Snyder from Alhambra Partners. So why don't we let him do the heavy lifting?
Well, after LIBOR is replaced by another set of benchmark interest rates, I don't think really a whole lot will happen to the Eurodollar system, because, you know, if you review the history of it from the very beginnings in the 1950s, one of the most prominent features is that it evolves based on circumstances and often evolves quite easily. So I would expect that the Eurodollar system, in whatever state it will be in, will simply evolve to whatever the next set of benchmark rates are, whether it's GC repo rates or whatever else might come along. The most recent round of FICC numbers from all the big banks were atrocious. There's no money in money. I think the emphasis on LIBOR and the interest rate that sets derivative markets is a little bit misplaced, largely because I don't think it's the fact that it's driving much of the impetus behind the Eurodollar market in general, especially the offshore currency markets. And what is driving these markets is bank capacity. And bank capacity over the last few years has gotten really bad, largely because there's no money in making money. You know, the latest round of FICC numbers from all of the big banks were simply atrocious, which means that these banks aren't making money out in the kind of money dealing capacities that we need for a healthy monetary system. And so the benchmark rate that sets, you know, the pricing of all of these securities is almost, I don't want to say it's unimportant, but it's kind of irrelevant to some degree. And what really matters is essentially the risk and return of doing these kinds of things that go on in the Eurodollar market. And for the last 10 years, really, The risk-return ratio has been flipped upside down from where it was in the pre-crisis era, where, you know, all of these banks got bigger as fast as they possibly could on the idea that there was very little risk and all return. And without being able to make money in the post-crisis era, it's all risk and no return. So there isn't a whole lot of appetite for increased euro-dollar capacity.
Jeff, I want to bring this to, you know, 30,000 feet for a second. When we when we consider all the political things that happened in 2016, and it's sort of, well, you know, we've in some ways, I guess you could say we've had a populist, a correction or recession in 2017. But do you see what's happening with LIBOR being sort of part of a larger theme of sort of this retrenchment, towards nationalism? And how does that affect the euro dollar market in terms of capacity as you're speaking about?
Well, I'm sure there's clearly some relationship there, because even people who are recalcitrant about what's happened the last 10 years have to realize that something isn't right. I don't think there's a whole lot of agreement on what exactly it is, and then certainly there's various opinions out there, politically as well as economic and financially. And so the idea that, you know, we need to replace LIBOR is one aspect of a larger theme, as you said, from 30,000 feet, which is that something isn't right here and we need to do something different. Again, I don't think LIBOR is the answer. I don't think it was ever really that much of a problem. Yes, there was, banks were fixing and conspiring to fix the price of it. But overall, it's the system that's malfunctioning. And so the system is what needs to be replaced. And then various places around the world, people who don't realize that that's the problem are looking to various different solutions in order to find an answer to what they know is something wrong. The economy around the world has not recovered from the Great Recession, which is, 10 years later. How is that possible?
So, Jeff, I want to actually I want to keep this focus on the euro-dollar market for a second, but I recently saw a chart that came out of the U.S. Treasury and IFR markets showing the actual and projected borrowing in marketable debt for the U.S. government, and that's like slated to go up to, I think, $500 billion, up from $100 million right now. How do you see that affecting liquidity in the euro-dollar market or just like broader dollar liquidity around the world?
Well, it could have a positive impact because, one of the prominent features of, not strictly euro dollars, but the euro dollar system has been the lack of repo collateral. Before the crisis hit, it was common to have repo collateralized by mortgage bonds, including a subprime mortgage bond. And so as that part of the repo system was pared back by the crisis and the rejection of especially subprime mortgage bonds, it's left the repo part of the markets pretty bare of collateral. And of course, quantitative easing didn't help because it removed even further marketable U.S. treasuries from the possible use of the repo system. So anything that increases the amount of good collateral, pristine collateral in the system could be a positive. However, that still doesn't overcome or it doesn't get beyond the idea that the risk return capacity of the system is all wrong. And so it may aid in the liquidity aspect of the euro-dollar system globally, but it's still we still have much bigger problems than that.
Jeff, if I can, your presentations on Real Vision about the plumbing of the euro-dollar market have been just some of our most popular presentations we've had. And in those, you make a case for a very strong dollar. Now, the dollar bull market is at a point where we've had five consecutive months of falls, and a lot of people are starting to question whether the bull market is still in place or whether we've entered a new bear market. So I'd love to get an update from you, if I can, on where you think the state of play is in the dollar bull market.
Well, I think that, perspective of the dollar bull, from my perspective anyway, is that, this euro dollar decay or euro dollar destruction, however you want to characterize it, which often becomes a dollar shortage, is not a linear event. It doesn't just go in a straight line. It's an intermittent phenomenon. There was a major crisis in 2008, a re-crisis in 2011, then again starting in 2014. I think we're past that part of it, but we haven't broken out of the entire paradigm, which is since 2007, dollar decay or euro dollar retreat, whatever you want to call it, euro dollar erosion. And so we're in this reflation period between these dollar events where it looks like, okay, things are getting better again. The dollar might fall. Some people say that the dollar is acting like it was in the middle 2000s and early 2000s, the so-called Bush weak dollar period. I think that's another kind of false rally, or in this case, false decline in the dollar's index value, simply because the last dollar event was, you know, almost a year and a half ago now, and we haven't seen the kind of destructive impetus that had been for several years straight. So, you know, I'm of the opinion that it's more of a dollar pause than any kind of inflection or change in the overriding paradigm.
Nice. All market conversations lead back to the dollar. It's like Rome.
As they should.
Yeah. I mean, like it or not, we still live in this dollar hegemonic system. But, you know, Jeff, as Grant said, I mean, we really need to get you back on Real Vision TV, and, you know, your presentation, one of my favorite presentations out there, just in, you know, exposing a topic that few understand, and your ability to communicate it and illuminate it is incredible. So hopefully we can get you back on soon.
Appreciate it. More than happy to.
So Grant, nothing changes, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, look, Jeffrey's right. It's an adaptive system, right? That's what it does. I mean, it's survived everything so far. I don't think a little thing like dismantling it's going to make any difference to it. But it's interesting what he talks about in terms of the dollar and this idea of dollar liquidity. It's such crucial market dynamic right now. Everybody kind of has to have a view, whether you want one or not. You have to have a view on it, because whichever way it breaks, it's going to lead to a cascading chain reaction of one kind or another, and you have to be prepared for that.
And I want to highlight this question, because I think when we talk about the euro, when we talk about the euro dollar system and the US dollar, those two things are so essential to the plumbing of the global financial system that, you know, whoever's listening to this, I hope you guys do dig a little bit deeper. And if you are a Real Vision TV subscriber, go and check out Jeff's presentation.
Yeah, absolutely.
He goes through the whole thing.
Astonishing detail.
It's great. And you'll come away thinking about the global financial system very differently, and you'll definitely learn something new. So it was great to get Jeff to answer that question for us.
Yeah, the other question that we received so many inquiries on was the FANG stocks. Obviously, they've taken up so much space in the headlines for, I mean, I've lost count of how many months now. And again, you know, Aaron...
Kind of nauseating, actually.
It really is. But we decided the smart thing to do for everybody's benefit was to get a good answer from someone that really follows this stuff. And we just figured, who better than Michael Oliver of Momentum Structural Analysis?
All right, so we have Michael Oliver on the line. Michael, it's great to have you join us today.
Thank you for putting me on this show today. That's great. Appreciate it.
For our listeners who are not familiar with you or your work, can you just give us a brief introduction?
Oh, sure. Momentum Structural Analysis is a private technical research firm. I started in 1992. We provide technical research to institutions and high net worth individual investors. Our approach is totally different than most price chart-based technicians. We do look at price, but we consider it a secondary technical feature. We consider what's more important, the momentum trend structures that are developed. When you analyze price, not in relation to a money unit like a regular price chart, but when you analyze price in relation to dynamic metrics such as moving averages. And by that, I don't mean you simply lay a moving average over the price chart. Anybody can do that. But we actually create oscillators based upon how does, for example, Amazon's action this week look in relation to a 200-week moving average or a 200-day moving average, et cetera. And we plot those charts. And when we do, we often find that the momentum will give you a different and often clearer picture of a trend situation than will the price chart. And usually, the trend changes will occur first on momentum and then secondarily in price. Anyway, with that as a backdrop, we've been doing it since 92, and we're very pleased with our record.
Well, that's fascinating. Michael, speaking of momentum, we had a question come in from numerous of our subscribers and listeners about the FANG stocks. Now, the FANG stocks, for those who don't know, that's Facebook, Amazon, Apple, and Netflix, and Google. And it's almost kind of acquired this sort of mythological kind of ethos now where, you know, everyone's talking about FANG stocks and it's the talk of the town. But can you give us your view on what's happening with the FANG stocks right now as it relates to momentum, price action? What are you seeing on that end?
Well, actually, we've been focusing on them for several months because it's clear that's where you have to focus. The leadership is very narrow now. And if the leadership goes in a whoosh, which often blow-off markets will, in other words, when they unravel quickly. Despite the effort of the broader market to hold up with this, that, or the other sector, they will be dragged down with the FANG stocks. So that is an important area. There's no question about it. What we look at is, in particular, within the group, we look at Google and Amazon. We think those two are probably the prime ones to watch. Over time, fundamentally speaking, although we're not fundamentalists, we're confident those stocks will be with us for a long, long time, regardless of what their price does, up or down. So if they do suffer a collapse after their recent blow-off, that doesn't mean anything fundamentally to the long-lasting nature of the stock. We're not so sure about Facebook and Netflix. Those are variables that could come and go. Another place to look is PNQI. It's an ETF of the internet stocks. And it comprises four of those stocks minus Apple. And so it's another sort of a mini collective place to look for the behavior of that group. We also look very closely at Amazon and Google. In fact, we just put out a significant report on Amazon just last night, which if your listeners would like, they can access it if they'd like. But Amazon in particular and Google are both behaving about the same. In fact, today, right now, before we started our chat, Amazon and Google both have been about $10, which for them is not a big deal, of numbers that if they hit particularly close a day at or a week below, they're in bigger trouble than the recent drop would indicate. I strongly suspect that when these stocks do break, and I think they could suffer, let's take Amazon for example, if you break the 971 level, which is a number applicable this week, next week it'd be 977. If you break that, it would not shock me to see at least another $100, $150 drop. And then suddenly you're looking at a stock that's 20, 25% off its high. Now, it can rally back as strongly as it wants, but it's highly unlikely to re-achieve that high if it suffers that next phase of the drop. So we could be looking at a top in the leadership of the market here, given about another 1% drop in those two symbols, Google and Amazon.
Well, Michael, you know, it's reading your work, it's fascinating, and having listened, watch your Real Vision TV interview, I think some of the work that you do is really unique on the technical analysis side and things that probably most of, I would argue, vast majority of our listeners and subscribers haven't encountered in the past. Can you just remind our listeners again where they can find your work?
Yes, it's Oliver, MSA for Momentum Structural Analysis, olivermsa.com. And there's a tab in there that you can look around at our methodologies explained in various layers. There's a visual of the history of our calls at the S&P. And there's a query box that you can ask for samples. And if you'd like this Amazon report, we're happy to send it out to you.
Michael, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us. And thanks for the great information.
Thank you.
So, yeah, Grant, I think Michael has such an interesting view here because, as I said in the interview, this is technical analysis that I think people aren't normally exposed to. I mean, you can probably find some momentum indicator that someone's written up on whatever charting platform you're using, but it's I don't know, it's just really interesting to hear from Michael, someone who has devoted decades to building these things, and then, you know, talking about how you separate Google and Amazon away from the other fangs, and then that's how you start your analysis. So it's great to hear from Michael on that.
It was. I love the technical guys that have built these frameworks. I just love the confidence they have. You know, having done all the work, they just have this confidence, and they say, you know, if it breaks my level, I'm all in. I trust my indicators. It's always fascinating to me.
Yeah, it really is. And for me, technical analysis is a great, great tool for risk management. You know, if you're thinking about how to get in and out of positions. And if anyone's interested in reading Michael's report on Amazon, feel free to reach out to us at podcast@realvision.com, and we can send you the report, or you can go to Michael's website, olivermsa.com. They'll send you the report for free. All right, Grant, so last question, and this is kind of a selfish question. Who would you most like to interview that is not like a hedge fund manager or not like a rock star analyst?
Well, I have a long list of people that I really, really want to interview.
Give me the top one, though.
Well, it's a great question. You know, if you gave me one right now, anyone that's on Twitter, if you're not following Rudy Havenstein, then you need to follow him. And Rudy, if you're out there listening, you are my number one request. I would silhouette you. I would alter your voice if you want to remain anonymous. But you are one guy that I would just love to sit down and talk to. So yeah, Rudy Havenstein on Twitter, @RudyHavenstein. If you don't follow him already, yeah. He is extraordinarily prolific.
Yes.
And the quality of his tweets is just so high it embarrasses the rest of us.
I asked him one time, Grant, I'm like, how do you tweet so much? And he said, yeah, it's just like a stream of consciousness. Like it just comes down. It's just...
Well, I would love to find out how that consciousness works because it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
So Rudy, buddy, if you're listening, come on, don't be shy. We can do this and we will maintain your anonymity, I promise you.
Well, Grant, that brings us to the end of our sort of abbreviated summer series.
It does. It's been fun. I've thoroughly enjoyed this one. Yeah. Maybe that's because we've worked for half as long this week. What do you reckon? Perhaps it's that. The sun is shining, so maybe we can get out the office before the hours of darkness. Yeah, right. Now, one last thing before we close. We've had an incredible amount of interest from you guys out there who are looking at potentially filling Aaron's position. We've got a few more days left. The deadline for submissions is the 7th of August. So please, if you are interested, send us an email to podcast@realvision.com. In the subject line, put podcast hosting position and send that through to us. And we will get back to you as soon as possible. So I guess that's it. We are done for the first in our summer series. We'll be back next week. Aaron, do we do a disclaimer this week or not?
You know, we should do one for old time's sake.
For old time's sake, all right.
Not because the lawyer told us so.
No.
Well, this is it. Anything you heard on this episode should not be considered as trading advice. These are our opinions and the opinions of our contributors only. So do your fundamental research, chart your own technicals, place your stops and trade responsibly.
Yes, and now I believe that leaving us reviews in the summer has a negative effect, so do not leave any reviews. Whatever you do, don't leave a review.
The classic reverse psychology. Well, having said that, if you've got any interesting questions about this week's show or anything else for that matter, we'd love to hear it. Just send us an email or voice note at podcast@realvision.com. And if you enjoyed what you heard, please subscribe on iTunes and leave us a review, as Grant
said. Don't worry about the reviews. It's the summer. Take 5 minutes.
No, leave us a review. When other people are taking off, you should leave us a review.
If you want to keep up to date with the latest interviews, research publications, and, of course, our podcast, then please do follow us on Twitter, @RealVision.
You can find us hanging out on Facebook and LinkedIn. Just search for Real Vision.
And, as always, you can follow me on Twitter, @TTMYGH.
You can follow me, @MacroDidact. And that's it from us.
We will see you next week. Happy summer.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.